This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media Medical News Network. We're about to speak to Dr. David Adamson. Welcome to Utopia Media Medical News Network.
Thank you, Mark. It's nice to be here.
Why don't you tell us first what Advanced Reproductive Care, Inc. is and what your position there is?
Advanced Reproductive Care is a national network of fertility clinics, and the purpose of the network is to bring high-quality care to infertility patients and also to provide affordable solutions. We have packages of clinical services and financing and a refund guarantee. And I founded this company about 8 years ago now, and I'm still the chairman and CEO of it.
It's pretty much a one-stop shop for fertility resolution.
That's what we like to be able to provide to our patients, and we've been very successful. We have thousands of patients who've used our services.
Say a little bit, just as much as you want, about your medical background and how you ended up doing this.
Sure. I came actually down to the United States from Canada to do my training here in the United States, and I'm in private practice in Northern California, and I'm also a clinical professor at Stanford and UCSF and been involved nationally in different organizations, including consumer organizations such as Resolve and the American Fertility Association. And through those activities, I came to realize how difficult, certainly emotionally, infertility is for patients, and how big a challenge often the costs are, because insurance frequently does not cover the cost of treatment. So I put this company together about 8 years ago with really good doctors who are reproductive endocrinologists who we carefully select for the network, and then put together programs that we thought could be helpful for the patients to take away a lot of the anxiety and stress and help provide financial assistance to them so they could get their family started.
It's not really what we're going to talk about here, but just if you can encapsulate it, where do you get that money for them in general?
Some of the money comes from the patients themselves because they pay for the services, but we have packages of services that provide discounted care,
right,
and also free services, so
right,
they get very advantageous pricing. And secondly, we have financing programs where we work with a major lender, Capital One, to provide financing for patients so they can spread the cost out over time.
So it's not just people in at Stanford who have to borrow money and pay for it for the next 10 years. People can essentially pay off the children they get through in vitro fertilization over a several-year period.
Well, they can certainly pay for the services over time. And
right,
the practice I'm in is Fertility Physicians of Northern California. We rate the across the street from Stanford,
right,
and certainly in our practice, a lot of our patients use the program because they really find it a convenient way to be able to get their family started when they're younger, when they want their children, and of course when their chances are better, because being younger helps with the chances of getting pregnant.
Okay, and apart from its geographical propinquity, what kind of relationship does ARC have with Stanford University Medical Center and the medical school and the researchers there? Presumably you're able to get the new discoveries soon after they're discovered.
Well, I'm a clinical professor there, so I teach the students, but the ARC by and of itself does not have any direct relationship with Stanford. The practice that is my practice with another four reproductive endocrinologists, fertility physicians, is completely separate. So we're in private practice. And
okay,
that's an academic career for me where I trained and taught and have done some research in the past, and now it's mostly teaching that I do there.
Okay. There's a whole world of in vitro fertilization and other fertility issues that maybe we can talk about another time, but right now I want to focus on the stem cell aspect of your work. You recently testified before a committee of the California State Senate that was considering SB 18, a bill to add some legal provisions regarding the collection of human eggs from women to be used in somatic cell nuclear transfer or cloning. What was the gist of your testimony?
The gist of my testimony actually had to do with the desirability of encouraging women to be egg donors. The bill that had originally been proposed, first of all, it called for a moratorium on egg donation,
right,
which would have been a very serious problem if it was extended to women who were trying to have babies, because right now there's about 10,000 egg donor cycles per year done in the United States, which probably results in 5,000 or 6,000 babies. So there's a lot of women who currently use egg donation in order to get their family started, And there was a risk, even though the bill technically applied to research, that with the moratorium it could complicate the ability of women who wanted and needed to use egg donors for medical reasons to get their families, would not be able to get egg donors.
Was that provision still in there when you testified?
No, that provision fortunately had been removed as a result of input from medical professional societies such as the American Society of Reproductive Medicine. So the bill was reduced to one that was dealing with just research, and we felt that was good, but it still, the bill called for no compensation of basically any type for women who are egg donors.
Right.
And in fact, egg donors really go through a long period of stress and contribution in terms of getting tests done and taking shots, having ultrasounds, having to go through an egg retrieval procedure, and it's standard practice to have women get some compensation for all of that, plus the risk that they go through to provide eggs. So that
is it possible to quantify what the standard or the measures of central tendency in the range are for compensation for women who donate eggs for fertility purposes?
Yes, it is, because the Ethics Committee of the American Society of Reproductive Medicine has looked at this issue very, very carefully, and they have an ethics statement which can be found on their website, which is asrm.org, and in this statement they find that, after a lot of consideration, that compensation up to $5,000 for going through the process of egg donation can be reasonable, and that in very exceptional circumstances, if it can be justified for the unique situation, potentially up to $10,000, but never more than $10,000. And so there actually are some very, you know, hard standards that have been set by the Ethics Committee, and it's our view that it would be best for the legislators to use those guidelines that have been established after a very large amount of thought by a wide variety of people, not only professionals and physicians and scientists, but also ethicists and attorneys, religious leaders, and others who've looked at this situation and on average feel that that's a reasonable amount of compensation for going through the egg donation process. It's really important to point out that the women who do the egg donation are not paid for the eggs, because regardless of whether or not any eggs are developed when you go to get the eggs, it's sometimes possible not to get any eggs, or regardless of the number of eggs,
right,
or regardless of the quality of the eggs.
So they're paid what they're paid for going through the process, not on a per egg basis,
exactly,
or an any egg basis.
Exactly.
And so if they end up with 10 or 100 eggs, they're not going to get $500,000.
That's right. It doesn't make any difference in the payment. And the other factor that we think is important is that the egg donation process for the woman is the same whether she is going to donate the eggs for research,
right,
or whether she's going to donate the eggs for someone to have a baby.
Okay, so you made that point to the legislators.
Yes.
Have they adopted that, or did they disregard that, or what?
The legislators currently adopted the language that was before them, which called for no compensation except for some direct expenses.
What does that mean?
Direct expenses would be, say, a plane ticket that had to be paid to get an egg donor somewhere.
Right.
And so what we're actually doing is we're working with the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and we are in the process of working with Senator Ortiz's office to talk about a language addition which would encourage, which would put into the law and make it the law that the ASRM, American Society of Reproductive Medicine, Ethics Committee guidelines would in fact be appropriate for compensation.
So as the bill now reads, it doesn't allow for compensation, only direct expenses, but you and the ASRM would like to see it say that women could get $5,000 or in some cases 10.
Exactly, yes.
Okay.
And regardless of whether the woman donates for research or whether she donates for the making of babies, it would be the same. There's another complication that comes up here in that if a woman donates her eggs to a couple so that they can have a baby.
Right.
And then they have a baby.
Right.
But they have extra embryos.
Right.
It's not entirely clear to me that that couple might then be precluded from donating those embryos to research, because the woman who donated the eggs to the couple had received some compensation for donating eggs to the couple. So,
okay, well, this is a whole another ball of eggs here to get involved in, but when the women do this egg donation, do they sign over all rights to them to the couple that they're providing them for?
Yes. Now, that's, you know, understandably and regrettably, historically, there have been a few situations in which the, you know, contractual arrangements were not clear enough in advance.
I assume that's happening less as bad cases make bad.
It almost never happens now.
Really,
the standard now is that when the egg donor gives up the eggs for the recipient, that at that time she relinquishes all rights and, by the way, all responsibilities for those eggs. And the rights and responsibilities at that point belong to the woman and the couple who are using those eggs, including the rights and responsibilities with any embryos that are frozen, you know, and left over after the process.
Okay, it's apparent that almost every point in this discussion can lead off into plenty more areas of complication and interest, but we're not going to be. I'm going to try to keep a straight line here. How much more time would you say we have? Because
I have a few minutes, but I'd just like to segue off that point,
right,
which you made, and this is one of the reasons that I feel, and that the ASRM, American Society of Reproductive Medicine, feels that it would be very appropriate for the law to have language that says that, you know, compensation is consistent with the guidelines from the Ethics Committee of the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, because you're absolutely correct. You can come up with so many different scenarios. It's very difficult to predict all these even today, let alone the fact that new technologies and new opportunities will come forward, and we're concerned about having legislation now that would put things in stone and yet maybe very inappropriate for, you know, new conditions, new developments,
right,
even 2 or 3 years from now. And that's
right,
one of the reasons we really think the professionals should be involved in trying to set these standards for society.
Right.
Now, with, of course, everybody being involved, ethicists, et cetera.
You're saying the ASRM has a set of ethical guidelines and presumably a model consent form that they like people to use?
They have instructions for developing consent forms. They don't have a single model consent form because the law is different in different states, and this is, of course, a national organization.
Right.
But yes, they have a document regarding elements of informed consent, which talks about all the things that should be included in a consent form.
Okay, because
so there has been a lot of work done on that as well.
There are at least two other issues that we're not going to be able to go into in much depth or at all, really, is the state-by-state basis versus a national or even international standard for this. And secondly is the question that the scientists are moving ahead faster than the politicians, and that it's hard for them to keep up, and a lot of problems can potentially develop because of that.
Well, I think the short answers are that, yes, there are a lot of differences from state to state, country to country, and internationally. The UN, as you know, is trying to deal with legislation on this.
Right.
I think it's reasonable for states and then countries to come up with types of legislation that's appropriate for them, and to keep the dialogue moving forward so that gradually there will be international standards, I do believe, but the international standards will always, you know, be trailing in time somewhat behind what happens in, for example, California, I think, is the very front end in developing
right.
this type of legislation.
Okay, well, maybe we may get back to that. Oh, in what ways does egg collection for embryonic stem cell research purposes differ from egg collection for purposes of in vitro fertilization, or a term I just learned today, intracytoplasmic sperm injection?
Well, it doesn't really differ.
Okay.
And that's the point. The process that the egg donor goes through
right.
is for practical purposes, identical.
Right.
She's donating for a couple who want to have a baby, or whether the eggs were donated for research, which is why we think they should be treated the
right.
same way.
Okay. What rules do you think need to be established to govern the collection? So you're saying then that the regulations or rules or laws governing the collection of eggs, the compensation to the women, and all of the legal procedures ought to be identical for women giving eggs for in vitro fertilization and women giving eggs for embryonic stem cell research?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, of course, there'd be additional and separate types of informed consent,
right?
Whether you're donating eggs for a woman who is going to try to have a baby,
right,
as opposed to research. So I'm not suggesting that wouldn't be
right.
Well,
the actual process
of the egg donation is not different, and so we think it should be managed the same way.
And the protections should be the same.
Absolutely.
How would you distinguish it, as briefly as you can, between the different points that would need to be made in the case of fertility resolution versus embryonic stem cell research in the informed consent agreement with the donor woman?
Well, in the informed consent, it would be very important, of course, to deal with all the usual rights and responsibilities in research, and the fact that if you do make eggs, and at some point, if they're frozen or embryos are frozen, that there's a very long ongoing potential for the research to go in different directions.
Right.
And those eggs may be used in different ways, as opposed to, say, when you're using eggs to make a baby, you're using those eggs just for a baby. So they're
and
more
pretty much
unknown
pretty much that you're going to use them, and pretty much that you're going to use them right away.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so you have to, but those questions really come down to what's involved in the IRB, the Institution Review Board,
right,
and the research being carried out. And so all that would be covered under the usual process for performing research. So it doesn't change the actual informed consent process for the egg donation per se, but it does change the informed consent for what you're going to do with those eggs once you get them, and the research and all those issues, which clearly has to be individualized for the particular situation with respect to the research.
Okay, well, two issues about that. Do you believe that women egg donors ought not to have any proprietary rights in any of the discoveries that are developed from their using their eggs?
My sense is just a general principle, and I suppose one could always find an exception, but I think once the eggs are donated, the rights should pass on to whoever is those eggs are being donated to.
Okay,
that's my sense.
Including also, as you mentioned, the right to use them in research that doesn't exist, types of research that don't exist now.
But that would be part of the informed consent process.
Right.
You'd say, yes, it can be used in any research that has, IRB, approved consent.
Okay.
But not in any other type of research. Now, understanding, so the answer is yes, I think in any kind of research, assuming, of
right,
course, that research is being ethically
right
and responsibly carried
right
out.
Right, of course, right. Now, so rushing ahead to what we may deal with at more length later, let's say that institutional review boards, that these eggs are donated today, they're frozen, they're stored for 5 years or 10 years. Is that physiologically possible?
Well, egg storage egg freezing, you have
right
to freeze them to store them,
right,
is being done, but it is not very successful at this point in time.
Okay.
But there's a lot of research going into this, and I think that possibly within a very short period of time, we may in fact have much improved technology for cryopreserving oocytes and having them survive the thaw. The technologies have been improving in the past few years, and I'm hoping and thinking there's a good chance of a lot more improvement in the next few years.
Okay, could you distinguish between oocytes and eggs?
Yeah, they're the same.
They're the same, just different words for the same thing.
Yes.
So if those breakthroughs take place and chiropreservation is developed so that eggs could last 5 or 10 years and then be thawed out and used, let's say an institutional review board in 2015 and public opinion and the law and so on has reached the point that human reproductive cloning is a good thing and everyone wants to do it. Could eggs donated today be used for that purpose then under the circumstances that you've described?
Well, I think from a physiologic perspective, the answer would probably be yes. From an ethical perspective, it would be my suspicion that any IRB board might well say that you can only use eggs collected going forward, because this is such a significant departure in the research that if you didn't consent the patient in the first instance
right.
to that use, you wouldn't be able to in the future. Because as you know, with research, the informed consent, you know, needs to include, you know, some specificity about what's going
right.
to happen
Although,
with the eggs. And so it would depend on the initial informed consent.
Right. If the initial informed consent, do whatever you want with them now and forever.
Well, if it says that, and the IRB down the road says that cloning is acceptable, then that would be, you know, something that, that the eggs could be used for.
Or if they kept in touch, they could go back to the person and say, is that okay now?
In theory, they could go back to them. And see, I think that for practical purposes, what would happen is that an IRB in the future would likely say that because cloning is such a departure, we would have to consent people on a going forward basis
okay.
and not use eggs historically. That would be my suspicion. And from a personal perspective, what I would argue is any IRB that looked at this would have to say, okay, we can do this, but only going forward. We will have to consent people specifically for this, in other words.
Legacy eggs and legacy informed consent might not be enough, you think?
That would be my personal view, but
okay.
You know, hopefully there would be a national policy developed on it, and you'd go with what the sense of the, you know, the experts were at that time. And
right.
as you pointed out, this is a very complex area, and I don't think the issues are going to go away. We're going to be living with
right.
them for the next 50 to 100 years,
right.
and we should start the social dialogue to deal with these.
That's the purpose of this conversation, to lay the
yes.
groundwork for that. apparently, an essential element in egg collection for any purpose, in vitro fertilization or embryonic stem cell research, is the use of Lupron. Am I right in thinking that? Is Lupron used in almost every case?
Well, it's commonly used, yes. I wouldn't say that it's essential. There are other drugs that can be used, but Luprolide, generic name, is commonly used. There's another drug called naphthalene and acetate or Cinerel, which can be used. There are also antagonists, cetrotide, ganirelix, that can be used as well.
Briefly put, how do they work?
They essentially work by turning the ovary off that it won't work on its own. And basically, we turn the ovary off with those drugs, and then we stimulate the ovary with the ovarian stimulation drug so that we can control what the ovary is doing. We don't want the ovary doing its own thing while we're trying to control it with the stimulation drugs.
And does the turning the ovaries off with the Lupron essentially build up some kind of pressure that when the fertility drugs are given, the hyperovulation takes place?
It doesn't build up any pressure. I think it just prevents development of follicles while you're preparing the ovary to start the stimulation drug. So, no, it does not do that.
Okay, but it's an essential part of the process.
It's an essential part of the process is to avoid premature ovulation, you know, when you're on the stimulation drugs, and that's what we use the suppression drugs, which are Luprolide, naphthalene, cetrotide, or ganirelix for.
Okay. Now, Lupron, I'm going to speak about Lupron, but I guess it's generic to those other drugs that you also mentioned.
Yes, they work in not exactly identical, but similar ways.
Okay. These drugs are not approved by the FDA for use in fertility treatments, are they? Or are they being used off-label, as we say?
Well, you know, Luprolide's used off-label, and I think naphthalene is. I'm honestly not sure about the other two.
Okay.
I have to check. But
so they may be used on-label.
They may be used on-label, and it's important to point out, as you know, that a large number of drugs are used off-label.
That's right.
And there are very legitimate reasons
That's
why
right.
drugs are used off-label.
That's right.
So I don't think there's, you know...
There's no reason as such to say that off-label use is... There's anything wrong with it.
Exactly.
As such.
It's
okay.
It's very appropriate. You know, very often it's very appropriate. Certainly in this case, I think it's very appropriate.
But in fact, when Lupron is used in these cases, it is being used on an off-label basis.
It is an off-label
okay.
use. That's correct.
Right. Now, it's made by a company called TAP, which is formed by some sort of merger or joint venture between
Takeda-Abbott, I believe.
Takeda-Abbott, right. Pharmaceuticals. Tell me what Lupron Depot is. I can't find it on the web. It says Lupron is called Lupron Depot, and it's called Luprolide Acetate for Depot Suspension.
Right.
What is Depot Suspension?
Well, Depot means it's an intramuscular injection. It's a longer lasting injection.
Okay. All right.
And that lasts a month and have a longer preparation as well. But you also have Luprolide that's used on a daily subcutaneous injection, which is what we almost invariably used in IVF
okay.
when it's used.
I spoke to a representative of TAP a few days ago and asked to get their comments on the use of Lupron in egg collection. I was told that they'd have no comment, that they only talk about Lupron in the context of medical conditions for which it is, quote, indicated, by which I assume they meant specifically approved for use by the FDA. Do you know what the status is of any research studies or anecdotal reports or surveys done by TAP about the use and problems with Lupron?
Well, you know, all I can tell you is that I've used, you know, Luprolide and all of the drugs in Naphrelin and, you know, the antagonist, Cetrotide and Ganirelix, you know, certainly Luprolide for, I don't know, a couple of decades now.
Right.
And the reality of it is it's an excellent drug, and the vast majority of women do well on it. I'm more than aware of some of, you know, some people who've had difficulties with it, but the bottom line is that for the vast majority of patients who take it, it's a very safe and very effective drug, and these drugs are safe and effective class of drugs.
Since you say they are safe and effective, as you've just said, do you think the TAP should take it to the FDA and get it approved for this use?
That's a commercial decision they'd have to make.
Is there any reason why they haven't, if it, as you've just said, it's safe and effective, which is what the FDA has to test?
Sure. The reason is the cost. I mean, it costs a huge amount of money to get drugs tested at the FDA, and this market, I suspect, is not big enough to justify the cost that they'd have to go through to use it. There are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of papers in the literature about the use of Luprolide over the past couple of decades, which shows that it's safe and effective in clinical use. And so there's no economic incentive for a company to spend millions or tens of millions of dollars, probably, to go do further trials. I mean, whether the drug is used, you know, the drug is used in men with prostatic cancer, and it's also used in women for other reasons, for endometriosis. So if the drug's been used in women for endometriosis, which it has been for years and which is an indication for it, and the drug's been shown to be safe and effective for that, there's really not a substantial difference. We use a different duration of dose, et cetera. But in my view, there's not any compelling reason that the drug would have to go through more tests simply because you're shutting the ovaries off for a different reason.
Okay.
So, I think frankly the arguments about this aspect of the use of the drug are overblown and exaggerated. I think it's by and large not a problem.
Okay.
That's not to say that some people don't have side effects or problems with it, because that can happen with any medication, but on balance, these drugs are very safe and very effective.
Okay. Do you also think that complaints about ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, OHSS, are similarly overblown, or do you think
I mean, ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome is clearly a potentially serious complication, but, you know,
tell people what it is exactly?
Well, ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome is a syndrome that consists of very large ovaries that result from the drugs that we use. It is called ovarian stimulation, and we stimulate the ovaries to make extra, you know, we make more eggs.
Right.
And so the ovaries get larger, and if the ovaries get too large, first of all, it's uncomfortable because the ovaries are large, and also there's changes in the permeability of the vascular system, so that you have fluid, you can get fluid collection in the pelvis and in the abdomen and in the chest. And you can get changes in the blood clotting system in very severe cases.
So, in your experience, how frequent does this develop into a problem?
Well,
frequently does this develop into a problem?
In fact, I can tell you, because I just looked at some numbers, and in the year 2003 in the United States,
right,
there were just under 10,000 egg donor cycles. Now, I'm only talking about egg donor cycles here. I'm not talking about general cycles, but just 9,960 or something like that.
Right.
And there were only 16 cases of moderate hyperstimulation and only 8 cases of severe hyperstimulation, which means that severe hyperstimulation, in which the ovaries are about 10 centimeters in size. So, you know, that's clearly important.
Right.
But that happens about, you know, once in every 1,200 patients who underwent egg donation. So fewer than 1 in 1,000 patients.
Are there systems in place at your clinic and elsewhere to monitor women for this? And
well, we monitor the women very, very carefully to try to avoid this. And the fact that you don't get it 999 times out of 1,000 or better means that by and large the systems work. But of course, there are no perfect systems. Cars have accidents and computers crash and lightning hits people, so
right.
Things happen. But we're very conscious about hyperstimulation syndrome, and we try very hard to prevent it. But, these are drugs we use. We are stimulating ovaries. Every patient is different, and, the practice of medicine is not perfect. So
okay.
You can have complications. But clearly, overall, the safety record with these drugs is extremely favorable.
Okay. You said there were about 10,000 donation cycles per year in the United States?
Yeah, this was in 2003.
2003.
These, of course, were for egg donation cycles that I'm talking about.
Right. So that means that's one woman going through one course of treatment and having one...
It could be. It's that many cycles. Some of the women undoubtedly did more than one cycle.
Right.
So it would be fewer than 10,000 women than approximately 10,000 cycles.
Okay. How big do you think the demand or the production would be to fully provision what's envisioned under the $3 billion embryonic stem cell research program that the Independent Citizens Oversight Committee and the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine are contemplating?
I honestly don't know the answer to that.
Can you give an order of magnitude estimate?
It would be a wild guess. Would be anything I could give you. No better than anyone else's. I'm not sure.
Could it be as many as 10,000 cycles per year?
I'd frankly be surprised if it were that many, but I don't know. I really can't give you an answer.
Okay.
I don't know the answer. There might be somebody who's involved with a stem cell company per se, which I'm not.
Right.
Who could give you an answer to that. I'm simply looking after people who want to have babies.
Right.
And so I've not been involved with any companies doing
okay.
that.
Okay. Right. Now, we talked a few minutes ago about how the ASRMNU believe that there ought to be compensation for women who do this for embryonic stem cell research purposes. Do you think that if there isn't, there will be sufficient donations to provision the research?
I think there's a very high probability there will not be enough.
Okay.
Women, and the experience in other countries has been that where there have been a prohibition of any type of payment at all, Canada being an example, and also in some European countries, what happens is that the patients start to leave the country to go to other places where they can get babies when they want babies. And I think that all the evidence is that there is a real process to going through egg donation. The patients have to, the egg donors have to have lots of screening. They have to spend a lot of time at this. They have to take injections. They have to, have tests. They have to go through an egg retrieval. So there's time, effort, emotional cost, potential risk to this, of course, with hyperstimulation. It's small but not zero. And I think, personally, it's more than reasonable to give them some reasonable level of compensation. And certainly a lot of people do this. There have been studies done on this that show that the women do this for altruistic reasons, but that the compensation, is felt to be appropriate for what they have to, quote, go through, end of quote. And again, I want to emphasize that the women get the same amount of money whether they get 30 eggs or no eggs, and whether they're good eggs or not good eggs.
It's for the process, not the egg.
Exactly.
Two questions about that then. Are you knowledgeable about or otherwise involved with long-term studies of the effects of this process on the egg donors? Has there sufficient study been done on that?
Not just on the egg donors per se, but our practice has participated in an NIH study of long-term follow-up of babies who have come as a result of IVF. We worked on that with the University of California, San Francisco. So the answer is yes, we are participating in studies to try to look at long-term outcomes.
That's long-term outcomes for the children who are born from the process. What about the long-term outcomes for the women who do the donating?
Well, we're certainly interviewing the mothers, and they are being asked about their health. And one of the problems, of course, with any of these studies, as you know, is trying to determine what the sample should be, defining the population, keeping the follow-up in place.
Right. As a general rule, in your case or as industry-wide, does the relationship between the donor and the recipients terminate when the process is over and the eggs are delivered and the check is cut for $5,000? Or if medical problems develop in the donors later, who's responsible for paying for them as a general rule?
Well, the donor's health plan would be responsible for that. There's not an ongoing financial commitment from the recipient. And in fact, most of the time, of course, the egg donation is anonymous. So the donors and recipients do not know each other.
But the clinics know who the person is. People can't wander in without giving their name, address, social security number to the clinics, people who do the operations.
We know
right?
who they are, but we clearly don't tell them
right.
because they've both chosen for it to be anonymous.
Right,
so
okay. Right.
That's what the agreement is.
The donor and recipient are anonymous to each other, but the donors are known to the medical professionals
right.
who are working
and
with
it's
them.
It's important to understand these drugs have been used now for over 40 years.
Right.
And there are a lot of long-term studies on this, and the short answer is that there really are not, any documented significant downsides to the use of these drugs. There are some studies that suggest there might be a somewhat higher incidence of what are called intermediate tumors. This is a very rare condition, a very rare tumor. It's not cancer. And that the incidence of this might be somewhat increased for women who've taken these drugs, but even that's not definitive. And the best evidence we have, recognizing that, there's no perfect evidence, but the best evidence we have is there's not a risk of ovarian cancer, which, had been considered a possibility over a decade ago.
What about the future fertility of the women, their ability to bear their own children?
There's no evidence that there's any reduction in this, and again, someone would say, you don't know for sure there's no risk, and we'd say, of course we don't, because trying to prove a negative is very difficult. But all the evidence we have, and from understanding how these drugs work, there's no reason to expect that the fertility of these women will be reduced.
Okay.
Now, again, we
yep.
don't know for certain, but the chances seem extremely high that there will not be, significant sequelae for this in the long-term health of the women.
Okay. Now, you've said that where there is, that in the case where there is no compensation for the donors, that donations tend to drop off. Are you worried, and have you seen any adequate provisions to deal with the risk that $5,000 may mean a lot more to poor women than it does to upscale women, and that the process, once a provision is in place that allows $5,000 payments per cycle or per process, that this will over-recruit among poor women in the United States and poor women globally, and that what some people criticize as egg farms will be established in order to provide the provisions for the stem cell research?
Well, that's obviously a complex and difficult question. And we always have to balance, harms and goods in a society. Clearly, what would look like a lot of money to a wealthy person here wouldn't look as much to a poor person. What, looks like a reasonable amount of money to a poor person here in this country would look like a fortune to somebody in some countries in the world.
Right.
So
there
are economic differences across our society and across the world that are real and part of everyday life, and I don't think you can prevent, every potential harm in society by saying, well, nobody pays for anything. And you have to look at the harm from not being able to go ahead and not being able to recruit, enough egg donors who would say, I'm altruistic and I want to do this, but yes, the money is helpful to me, and they do it, as opposed to not having eggs to do the research to help millions of people with disease. So I certainly wouldn't argue for a minute that some compensation for going through the process is a perfect solution, but I think it's a better approach to it than the alternative, which is absolutely no compensation for the process, which I think will result in a very reduced number of available eggs and therefore a real slowing of the potential benefits from the from the research that's available. So it's a balancing of benefits and harms. Intelligent people of good motivation and good ethics and morals will probably differ on where that is. And
okay.
The challenge to our society will be to find the compromise and the consensus that we can all live with.
Okay.
In the best interest of everybody.
All right. The point we're not going to talk about is what that potential is in the equation that you were talking about balancing the different aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to talk about that here, but I want to wrap up with a discussion of something that I'm sure you're more knowledgeable than almost anyone else is about, and I'm hoping to get some expertise from you about that. Are you totally opposed on scientific and or ethical grounds to human reproductive cloning?
Absolutely.
And why?
Well, you know, I think that it's I'm primarily opposed because, you know, the collective wisdom of our culture and our society and international society is that this is not a good thing. And I'm very respectful of, you know, a majority view when the majority is 99% of the people out there.
Right.
And I, while I believe I know a reasonable amount about this area and I've, you know a lot about reproductive medicine, I don't believe that I could make an intellectual argument, let alone a moral or ethical one, that would say I'm right and all those people are wrong about this.
Okay.
And so that would sort of be the first point. And the second one is that I do believe there are significant moral and ethical concerns about getting in this area, and that we are not at all aware of what the safety concerns would be, and the scientific concerns. But I think the bigger issue is that we don't have a social comfort about, you know, what the outcomes would be, and I think that we have to be in a totally different, you know, universe culturally and socially about this before it seriously could be considered to be something to do. So I don't really see it in my lifetime.
Okay, on a technical level, would you say that research that's being done in embryonic stem with embryonic stem cells, especially the techniques for somatic cell nuclear transfer or therapeutic cloning, would facilitate the creation of a knowledge base that would be of much use or of great utility in accomplishing reproductive cloning?
I think undoubtedly that the knowledge will, you know, put us closer towards the potential for reproductive cloning.
And on top of that, I imagine, since you're at the forefront of it, that advances in the continuing evolution of implanting and bringing embryos created by IVF to term are also taking place.
Yes.
And if you combine those, it's essentially, this research will itself make it more feasible to do human reproductive cloning should the ethical and other issues be resolved to say that it's allowed. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I think that's inevitable that it will take us closer to that.
Okay,
I think we have to have confidence in society to make the right decision.
Okay.
That we won't do it.
Given those forces, though, what do you think will stand in the way of individuals or groups who believe differently than the 99% and think it's okay to do it, it's advantageous, it's important to do it,
right?
What means are in place to stop them from doing it?
Well, I don't think any, but the problem is that if we don't, as a, you know, society, say a national initiative,
right,
have the knowledge, what will happen is that only those people who, you know, potentially have you know, inappropriate intentions,
right,
will have the knowledge. Whereas if we do it, at least we'll have, you know, comparable knowledge. And so
if cloning is outlawed, only outlaws will do cloning.
Yes, essentially, yes. And there are other countries which will do it. I mean, look at the nuclear issue now with,
right,
you know, North Korea and Iran. I mean, the fact that we say don't do it doesn't mean they won't do it. So
right.
I think it's important for the United States to be at the very front end of the science and technology and also the ethical and moral and social discussion of this. I don't think we can hide from this science by saying, well, we don't like it, so we won't do it, or we're going to let a few people stop us from doing it, because there are many places in the world where this will go forward and we'll simply be left, you know, way behind without, in a sense, an oar in the water to help you know, move to the debate and move the science in the right direction.
So,
we want to be leading this in the right,
right,
direction, not having to follow others who may not take it.
So you're essentially saying that you want to pursue a two-track approach in which the science and medical technology is developed, but that the ethical and moral questions are also debated and social constraints are put in place to prevent,
yes,
the use of them.
Yes.
To do that. Does this also apply to what's called germline manipulation, designer,
yes,
babies, and those
absolutely
type of activities?
Absolutely. I think we have to draw some very bright lines on those issues. And in our practice, we do that. We don't do sex selection for family planning or
You mentioned on your website that there are a range of genetic testing services. I imagine both commonplace and state of the art that are available at ARC. Do you do pre-implantation testing for Tay-Sachs or sickle cell anemia or other such?
Yes, we do that, but we don't do it, as I said, for sex selection or, you know, social reasons. We do it for medical reasons.
So that if you and if an embryo is found to carry the genes for some lethal malfunction, that that embryo is not implanted.
It's not implanted. That's correct.
Okay. One last question at the tip of this discussion. Maybe we're a little ahead of it, but I think, as you said, it's important to be on the leadership front at all of the discussion. Dolly has come and gone.
Yes.
The Savings and Clone group is making a designer is reproducing cat is cloning cats, and the an Italian lab produced a horse from a colt from a gelding announced it a few weeks ago. Do you think that the next step is, or are people working on primate reproductive cloning at this point with orangutans, chimpanzees, and gorillas?
I don't know the answer to that. It wouldn't surprise me. I don't have any personal knowledge of that.
Yeah, if that happens successfully, would that be another indication that the remaining technical steps to human reproductive cloning were being reduced and eliminated?
Well, I think they're being reduced. It's my understanding, and I am not an expert on some of the issues here, but it is my understanding that there are some fairly substantial challenges for considering this in humans, which are unique to humans.
Right.
So that even though there may be some of this, you know, quote progress, end of quote,
right,
on other fronts, I'm not sure that it's going to change the situation for humans. And certainly that's why I think we need to have the dialogue and get the social and legal protections in place in this country and around the world.
Have you or others given thought to the implications in terms of what could be called constructive human immortality that human reproductive cloning would imply and demonstrate and provide?
Well, I'm not a philosopher,
right,
or an ethicist, but
right,
in general, I would find that a fairly disturbing concept.
Right.
And you know, wouldn't be supportive of it. Everything in life, you know, is born, lives, and dies, and it seems to have worked in the universe. Not only people, but animals, plants, planets, suns.
Right.
So it seems to me,
some say the universe,
it would be unnatural, as it were,
okay,
to do that. And on that basis alone, I wouldn't be able to support it.
Although, of course, before Louise Brown, making babies in petri dishes was thought to be unnatural as well.
Yeah, that was. But I suppose we look on that as just assisting, you know, natural processes that couldn't occur. You can get into that the whole issue with medicine, of course,
right.
And you know, Christian Scientists, I think, believe that you know, medical treatment by and of itself is inappropriate,
right.
And so. Again, honest people of good intellect and I think high moral standing can have differing views on what type of interventions are appropriate.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to explain all this to me and to our listeners. And
well, thank you.
And I want to wish you continued good luck and success in your professional efforts there.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Okay. Talk to you again later.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.